Welcome to Mystic Babylon Poetry Podcast, broadcasting from near the Hayde in San Francisco. Today we are having part of a family of poets read today. Since I am recording the intro a little early, all I know is that Deborah Katab and Jeremy Siegel are going to be here. There might be others. Time will tell. They weren't positive who could all come. Deborah has been published both online and in print, for example, as of lately, in a 9/11 anthology called An Eye for an Eye Makes the Whole World Blind. She has been published as well in both online and print magazines, and her main contribution to the poetry community is to host the Word Beat Poetry Series in Berkeley and managing the website www.angelfire.com/poetry/wordbeat. I can't go into full detail about all her contributions in this intro. Hopefully she will add more info just before she reads and tell you where to buy her works. Jeremy Siegel is co-host to the Word Beat Poetry Series at the Mediterranean Cafe on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley with Deborah. I will, as usual, be reading from my book, Spirits of Bondage and Inherent Transcendence. Please post comments on my podcast site if you can, and it would be deeply appreciated if you bought any of the author's books who read herein. All this poetry is free, but to get the full versions, you will have to buy the books. I am a member of a poetry podcasting association at www.poetrypodcasting.org, and I try to put their members' promos on my podcast each episode. This time, at the end of the podcast, I am putting a promo for Little Red's Riding Hood Poetry Podcast. It is located at www.lrwh.us. I will put all contact info in the show notes at my poetry podcast site at mysticbabylon.podomatic.com. The poetry podcast will begin shortly. I will read first. The first poem I'm going to read is called Infirm. It is about the necessity of learning to humble oneself as greatly as the lowest and humblest existence, so as to learn respect for all of nature. To be specific, this existence or animal is the worm. No other animal strikes me as being humbler. Why is it that it is defined as low on the totem pole of reincarnation, but it is considered as humble as a bodhisattva? Here is the poem. Man seems a mere nothing when weakened and infirmed, as when he is colorless and pallid, like the worm, and is called by some a demeaning term. It seems, though, if man can crawl, he ought to be able to stand up to his fate instead of stall, and rather than swagger and speak contemptuously with a drawl, that all he knows is the calamity of bankruptcy and the fall, ought to be able to heed some righteous call. When the man, much like the worm, asks for a reward for doing much work, he is, like the worm, not paid for fostering symbolic flowers of inspiration in the garden of delight. Although man and worm, though beleaguered, succeed in making fertile both the earth and the mind as they mutually fight against failure, even though they still are only metaphorically struggling and groping. Through this thrashing about, they both find meaning in humility, as if coming in contact with the ground of being by connecting with the underpinnings of the mind, coming from crawling and probing around in the earth in mortification. Man begins to, because of this evasion of honor, feel funny, and he finds this inflexible posture of society unmanly, striking him as odd, strange, and uncanny. Is it also that his boss looks at him impatiently when he moves at a snail's pace and can't stand erect, and because he has a small ego, the cold stare of his superior makes him feel like he has a personality defect? There is no pay for the forbearance of ill will or disease, and if it wasn't for the pill, the attendant man to the ill would be totally unaccommodating, as Caesar, not the layman, foots the bill. He, sometimes being more ineffective than others, is still listless and feeble, and sometimes wishes that he, too, could be more like the worm who struggles and squirms to progress, because he, even though he fights too as if almost infirm, is never possessed by evil, and with a very strong will, the worm tries to be concerned about an earth-like upheaval, leaving no stone unturned. Thank you. This second poem, The Cat, is just a fun poem that I wrote about somebody who slightly resembled the character in the poem. He ran a hippie clothing store back in the 70s in Tucson, Arizona. Here is the poem. I knew a man who was a cat. He rode a Harley and was very fat. He lived in Babylon, where you must be begat. He had a Chinese father from Siam. His favorite food was ham. Ever since he left Siam, he was on the lam. This cat also refused to fight in Vietnam, but asked if he liked anger or what. He said he liked it because he could rhyme it with cat. He said of war he preferred peace, but he wasn't against eating some tasty meats. The man who was this cat that I knew was a very jealous cat, too. He would sing a song or meow to Sally, who was his girlfriend in Tin Pan Alley. He banged so loud on his pans that in that alley that he attracted the attention of Lieutenant Callie. It was then that he became afraid that he would take his girlfriend to ballet. He felt so proud that the chairman Mao thought he was the cat's meow. Thank you. This last poem, called Innocence, is about a person's inner sense of innocence before the all-too-common midlife crisis, which might be called in many cases by a simpler religious term, the fall. Here's the poem. When the world was new, innocence was all that was known. It went inside deep down to the bone. What was within innocence was the knowledge of innocence. There was only enough awareness within itself to awaken life's inner sense. Sometimes innocence was barely touched upon. It fit between rhythms and steps. Sometimes it pulsed like exercise reps. Over time, innocence was harvested and at the end of a season made into rhyme, then moved to a more adult dimension or lesion, and innocence became pantomime, which afterwards was rarely annotated or mentioned, but was given away like a nickel or a dime. It went without goodbyes, because with the spirit of the age, there was something that always seemed to arise, that came with old age and would come as a surprise. Innocence is an inside thing, and there is honor on being with innocence's lot. A bad episode it is not. I look from the outside now, but the thought of innocence still wrinkles my brow. And even though people rave and crow how low people can go, I say that about me sinning when I was young, it didn't happen and wasn't so. What is foremost is that petty sin and problems should not show. On the price of innocence, people shouldn't make dough. Even though I know people flaunt their money when they go out to a theater or a show. What happens inside innocence's door, people should know. Thank you. Next, the young Jeremy Siegel will read Before the Elder Deborah.
Hello, I am Mad Hatter Jeremy, and I run the poetry reading with my mom. I'm 15, and here's my first poem. Jumping up, jumping down, jumping all around. Kittens playful, romping around on the roof. Silly kittens, silly shadows, playing on the ladder. With the kittens, silly, that is why you are on the roof in the first place. Uh-oh, the ladder fell. Down now, what meow? I know, said one of the kittens. The wood box. They jumped down to have another adventure another day. Life, to some people, is but a dream that they will never possess, like a woman that had a baby growing inside her, with no brain, no soul inside him. To some people, life is a pain that they wish they could get rid of, like a catapult flinging you at a stone wall, and you hurting so bad you want to die. To some people, life is a joy they wish would last forever, like a new baby brother who you hold for the first time. This poem is based on a photograph by Sebastian Salgado of a man in a refugee camp dying of cholera. Cholera. The person dying looks up at me, he in pain, no one else to help. Swinging like a little rat, above the ground he thoughtfully sat. One of the snakes happened to go by. Zip, zip, he was off like a fly. Mouse wall. For there was a mouse on the wall, and there was a wall inside the mouse. He danced on the wall, just like a little mouse inside him every day. He played with the clock on the wall. Heart problems. Two problems, one you cannot fix. They think it will fully kick in at 1 to 3 years. You are happy that someone took you in. You have a happy life. You live to be 3. You almost forget about your problem. Then all of a moment, you're dying, going to sleep. Then your heart stops. Bye-bye, Chewbacca. Chewie for short. My first dog. Sleep wheel. Turning in my sheep is bad for the sheep. I count sheep and the sound of car tires. The clock second hand spins. I am a sleep-deprived zombie of myself, with dumbbells for eyes. And each time the clock strikes, it feels like my head is striking along with it. I stumble dimly into the morning, hungover from too little sleep, my body still aching for the bed I left. This poem is dedicated to Alan Cohen, my mom Deborah, and all the grieving people in the world. Grieving roses. Roses don't grieve like you or me. In fact, roses don't grieve like us at all. Roses grieve on the inside, unlike us who showed it in all kinds of ways. Instead of tear-stained faces, the skin of roses are white, yellow, red, and pink. But they turn brown and black over time. They turn, just like people, a rainbow of colors. But roses become a wilting flower, with droplets of tears against their petals. Poetry. Poetry is a challenge. A challenge with words. A test of words. That causes sweat on your forehead, under your armpits, everywhere, sweat. And nail biting until your fingers are bitten raw. Poetry is a challenge, which most people don't want to accept. But for the few who have the creativity, who can create a mask, a drawing, a poem, an inspiration for words. But for the few who do want to take the challenge of poetry, who know happiness is like magic monster cards and magic monster words, who know you have to battle for words as you do for magic, who know the happiness of others is the greatest reward. This poem is dedicated to my great-grandmother, Ruth Nelson, and my grandma, her daughter, Connie Staples. Alzheimer's. Forgetting your thoughts. Forgetting your memory. Forgetting your own daughter. You only remember the piano. Your only friend. You play and play, but your memory is getting fuzzier and fuzzier, dimmer and dimmer, as if you're in a tunnel, walking at first, then running, running down the tunnel of light. Closer, closer, you're almost there, then boom! All of a sudden, the tunnel is collapsing. You run as fast as you can. Too late. Rocks fall. You can't escape. Just like Alzheimer's, you can never escape. That happens. You forget how to breathe. You die. Goodbye be the last words you hear.
My name is Deborah Grace Katab. I co-host Wordbeat in Berkeley at the Mediterranean Cafe. I do the website and emails, which need to be caught up. I have been a double major in physics and English, and also married to my first husband was Palestinian, and currently I'm with 2 Jewish men, which has given me a fairly unique perspective. This poem that I'm reading was published in the 9/11 anthology, An Eye for an Eye Makes the Whole World Blind. It's called Let There Be Infinity. September 11th, I was scared shitless. The reggae mom at my kid's school said they were bombing the World Trade Center. She said the world was ending. I hurried away from my nervous laugh as Chicken Little's "The Sky Is Falling, The Sky Is Falling" tumbled over and over through my frozen thoughts that kept breaking ice, only to show a fox's hungry face. And then I turned on the TV, and then I trembled, and then I bowed my head before despair and prayers uncovered my face to the world. My brother-in-law, the same man who flew out to hold his first nephew, glowing face to sleeping face, bloodline seeking bloodline, before the newborn blue eyes had faded to brown, lived in New York. A New Yorker described seeing a woman holding her baby who jumped from one of the burning towers before he had to look away. Another said he saw a woman holding a man's hand as they both dropped to their deaths. Cousins who were cards, phone calls, Star Trek photos, and the kindness of a movie mailed to our depressed, hospitalized son lived in New York. An Australian man working in the Twin Towers described carrying purses and dragging four exhausted women to safety down hundreds of stairs. Another survivor with broken legs spoke on TV of the two unknown women who carried him to safety. A childless aunt slipping sideways into old age through the decay of independence, who once sent a gray mouse as big as a mouser that our little boy dragged through dust and dog hair. She still lived in New York. An office worker wept as he described a coworker who refused to leave a disabled friend in a wheelchair, who stayed with his friend until the towers collapsed on them. These, the remnants of my children's Jewish bloodline, offshoots of a family tree Hitler once tried to chop down, now in danger in New York City. The day ended before we heard they were all alive. Over and over I watched the planes hit, real-life special effects as the buildings collapsed and New Yorkers ran from the broiling clouds. My grandmother once described grabbing up my father as an infant and running before black walls advancing across Kansas Prairie, not knowing if it was dust bowl storms or a tornado, not knowing whether she would survive this time. These people on my TV, these New Yorkers, were being overtaken by the first wave of our uncertain future. And in their faces I saw that they didn't know if we would survive either. When I saw the first newspaper photos of jumpers with fire at their back, of trapped people clinging onto a ledge above the clouds, I wept and sang one of my mother's hymns. Oh, Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder, my mother's golden soprano, consider all the works thy hand hath made, echoing in my mangled version, I see the stars, I hear the mighty thunder, where the stars are stripped down in thunder, thy power throughout the universe displayed, is manifested over and over on TV. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee, as buildings collapse down around. How great thou art, how great thou art, all our hopes of safety. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee, all our hopes of sanity. How great thou art, how great thou art. Pacing around the apartment, I became another human animal caged by national circumstance. That night at a UUCB evening service, I couldn't stand up, couldn't speak, because my throat was roughened with unshed tears, with unshed fears, with unspoken names of relatives, of unnameable media-portrayed victims, of future racist victims who might be from my Muslim past. And from the past, Arabic names roll off my tongue, and the first surah of the Quran rises up to protest terrorist promises. Bismillahi ar-Rahmani ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, in mercy and grace my dead niece and great-grandmother were so named. Alhamdulillah, Allah, Rabba al-Alameen. Praise be to Allah, the cherisher and sustainer of the world. Let these spirits, this spirituality, help sustain and cherish those left behind on this world. Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, most gracious, most merciful. Gracious, adjective, too, compassionate. Merciful, adjective, showing mercy. Malak Yam Adihim, master of the day of judgment. How will the terrorists stand up? How will we stand up on that day? Iyaka na budu wadya niyaka nasta'in. Thee do we worship and thine aid we seek. Reverence, love, admiration, sustenance, all sought by so many. Inya sirat al-mustaqim. Show us the straight way. But 1.2 million tons of rubble block New York City streets. Sirat al-Zina, Anamta al-Raim, Gara al-Magda Alaim wal adalin, the way of those on whom thou hast bestowed thy grace, those whose portion is not wrath and who go not astray. Grace only bestowed on those who go not astray, who are not angry, wrathful mobs promising vengeance. On the TV, I see crowds waving unreadable signs and flags in all colors of humans angry and lost in the mob. I once memorized this surah. I once upon a time read all of the Quran. I know it never said to kill the innocent. Nowhere does it say to create 3,000 ghostly voices to rise up from a concrete grave. And then Ibrahim's name clutches my heart. Over and over, Ibrahim, being beaten, harassed, killed because he is Arabic. His laughing face that taught me to love him and myself is Arabic. His name, Khattab, which means to write. The name I kept as a guiding star into my future. His name is Arabic and a marker, just as the Star of David marked my children's Siegel ancestors for extermination. 14 years in love with Ken, married a decade to an ex-New York, ex-Jew hippie, and still I felt the loving bird Ibrahim left on my heart. A name from the Palestinian diaspora, a name from my first dead marriage. I stood on the hill behind UUCB where the necklace of cities and night were all that were between me and wherever Ibrahim was. And I finally said his name and spoke to him and sang to him. Burn, burn, or all is lost. There starts a second Holocaust. I thought of his family shot up in Lebanese refugee camps, his mother starving under siege by Christian Lebanese and Jewish Israelis, and Ibrahim retreating back into the madness of being the 13-year-old who just lost his father. So finally, I divorced the 13-year-old who wanted to go save his mother without me. I thought of the children, my son at 10 crying for people he'd never met, a Pakistani friend's son kept home for days in a tiny apartment filled with the footsteps of fear, a lawyer who held her sons until they slept and then wept that they might become soldiers. I was afraid to count the nuclear bombs we have stockpiled against the truth of our future. I am still counting the days other people want their gods to number for us, and I want infinity to become the universal count, just infinity. This is what does it for my niece, Grace Nation. Seeing a miniature coffin does it, brings back Grace, quiet and too white, too still a bundle of lace, cap and clothes gentle flat, but there is no breath to wrinkle it. Such a box for the grave should never be made that small, and I wonder, if I lay down and put my ear close to the earth, will I catch any of her lost heartbeats? Finding the Butterfly Cemetery, a poem in two voices. Voice 1, as the chrysalis opens. Voice 2, a young girl steps out, lace edging her face as a waterfall of blue silk hides her hair, and the sunlight catches her ankle and bare feet as the wind plays whippoorwill with her dress. Voice 1, wings unfold their crumpled ruffles from the chrysalis shell's edges. Voice 2, now a teenager, she watches one tall, silent brother march through the clanging gates of Saddam Hussein's Abu Ghraib prison. The same brother who pulled the edge of her veil when it wasn't tied right, who brought her sliced lemons and orange wedges as a treat. That brother never to be seen again as she works at sewing and patching the holes in her life. Voice 1. One wing smooths out and carves up the sunlight into its Red River stone mosaic of colors as a second wing crumples in on itself, holding too many bits and shreds of darkness to be anything other than a cave of empty promised flight. Voice 2. Now she stands at Abu Ghraib prison, tight black scarf, pants, gun, and rage dressing her intentions for the night, as Americans hold her last brother in the belly of this new version of hell. The brother who never talked much, who broke his arm when the bombs fell, who hesitated to fight. Her last brother. She almost flew up that wall. Voice 1. Without enough rain, the wing failed and fertility faltered as the fluttering butterfly hopped from branch to branch under the hungry gaze of birds. Voice 2. Now she's been released from that same Abu Ghraib prison, marks on her back from buckles and feet, her seeded womb a raped mark on any future she might once have danced under the wailing Iraqi moon with, and this last child of her line, imprisoned in the genetic intertwining of this Iraqi Muslim American Christian oil bled out war, may seal her fate when she reaches her grandfather's door. Voice 1 and Voice 2. Now she carries the butterfly, their crumpled wings shadowing the sunlight as they walk into the dawn, searching every street, park, and garden for the butterfly cemetery where they can bury the lost promise of their lives. Kitten on the Keys for Ruth Nelson. Thanksgiving on the farm was ham, turkey, corn stuffing, and every extra leaf in the oak table as we listened while Grandma played the maple leaf rag. Christmas, every extra mattress was laid out, decorations, cookies, chasing chickens, the treehouse, and Grandma played Silent Night as we sang. I ate her home canned green beans and plum jelly, inhaled her pickles, drank the juice to make my brother laugh, and sang along as Grandma played Shine On, Harvest Moon. My sister learned how to can her own acre of garden. I learned how to sing to pigs. Sweep, big, 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 big. Now Grandma and I play the entertainer 1,500 miles apart. Her firstborn Uncle David drowned at 12 and was buried on a Kansas farm. 24 more descendants scatter across state lines as Grandma plays How You Gonna Keep 'Em Down on the Farm. In the last decade, 2 farms sold, widowed, 4 moves, and the race is on. Alzheimer's versus cancer. But Grandma still can play Kitten on the Keys. Commencements, nuptials, christenings, funerals all fade as radio melodies learned when a teen dance under her fingers and Grandma plays I Love a Piano. My mother walks through the white door. Grandma nods her head and with a baby smile asks what her name is. But Grandma still plays Baby, Won't You Please Come Home. Gnarled fingers laced with arthritis flutter as my mother holds her mother's hand and Grandma plays My Little Girl. Grandma's gift is singing through my years, my tears. Pianos and children remember the dance and hug of her touch. And I promise her I will play Kitten on the Keys after you've gone. Smiling Monk, a Tonka. This is based on a photograph by Linda Connor, found at SF MoMA. Smiling Monk. Barren ground under the monk's feet. He smiles, knowing rocks go to dust, comfortable with time. Desert Sacrifice. I shred tulips against the thorns as I sway by the row of cactus, flat green punchy pad hands reaching out for me. Too close, and the communion white gauze of my dress delicately decorates a crown of thorns as white tulip petals fall at my feet, and I watch, wondering whether the drops of blood will fall next. A Child's Prayer for the Lost Hurricane Survivors. I am washing a jumble of dishes that rainbow our family of past together, subtle light green shadows arcing above intertwined baby roses, but none of the dishes are cracked or broken, and the water ends at the edge of my sink. There is a shattered teapot in the photograph on my computer screen. It is cradled in the arms of a split-open, waterlogged tree, shorn of its shade and heritage, and the moody water tugs at a headless Barbie doll in bedraggled pink. At a dump truck minus its wheels stuck in the mud, the receding water loses its angry grasp on the bloated body of someone's lost mother as a Louisiana police car drives quickly by. Any doubt you may have will disappear in 7 days. This is a fortune I got on a computer program called Shanghai Dynasty Fortune. And on day one, I did see the beggars fed and clothed with hot soup rolling down the middle of Telegraph Avenue, and merchants throwing open their store doors, while assistants carefully took measurements with long strips of promises and measuring tape, and dancers handed out bagels and paints. And on day two, I did see the rainbows begin, as children climbed up the side of stores and windows, dragging the bright colors behind them, like ant trails across a mighty edifice that bloomed colors mightier than the flowers. And on day three, the flowers began to sing, with dogs howling the underlines and bluebirds highlighting every third note, while professors sat at their feet and frantically scrawled down the importance of every note, so that on the fourth day the books came alive, emptied out of every bookstore and library, to crawl into the hands of all those who weren't professors, because they needed them to feed their dreams with one ripped out page at a time. And on the fifth day the dreams ran out of time and began to sit on the books, which piled higher and higher, until a road to the clouds called out for the children to come and paint them on the sixth day, because they were never meant to be white, just because the sky forgot its imagination. And when the sky woke up, it yawned and all the stars peered down from its mouth, curious at the day-outlined sights, until the cold black of space reached out and quickly plucked sparking bombs out of every hidey hole and subderanged marine, so that the seventh day dawned, and I had no more doubts.
Here is a promo from one of the members of the Poetry Podcasting Association. I hope you can visit her website.
Hello, and welcome to Little Red's Riding Hood, where passion in poetry is our only endeavor. Attempting to make the words leap off the page and into your soul. At Little Red's Riding Hood, that is what we want you to experience. Taking your emotional senses even higher than you ever thought possible. With an obsession for the written word and all that poetry brings to the imagination, as well as the heart, come join us for a literary sound experience combined with audible sensations truly from the heart that will forever enlighten your soul and sincerely open your mind. You can now add to the listening experience with the first edition of our book called Researchable Insights, now available to enhance that quiet time we all long to treat ourselves with. Leave a voicemail at 206-339-LRWH or translate it 206-339-5794. You can also be Skyped at, you guessed it, Terry68. Cannot wait to hear from you, and we look forward to having you join us for our next episode of Little Red's Riding Hood.
This podcast is a member of the Association of Poetry Podcasting
at poetrypodcasting.org.